It is Monday, July the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, are changes coming with Mexico's newly elected president?
My expectation is that there will be probably a much more of a continuation of current policy and strategy than there will be a departure from it.
Could North Korea be enhancing its nuclear sites? Also, the U.S. to get a new high court justice.
For civil rights cases, particularly gay rights, abortion, affirmative action, the court has the potential to profoundly change.
Also ahead, remembering singer Luther Vandross on the anniversary of his death. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Mexicans went to the polls on Sunday, choosing a new president, some members of their legislature, numerous other positions around the country. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who appears to have won the election with 49% of the vote, has been saying he will transform Mexico if he wins the presidency. The current ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, has conceded the election. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Wilson Center scholar Duncan Wood, who is in Mexico City, what kind of administration López Obrador might have.
I think that we'd probably like to see much more continuity than change. It's going to be on the economic front. We've had a pretty orthodox economic platform presented during the campaign. Fiscal austerity, financial stability, free trade, bringing in as much foreign investment as possible. On the political side of things, I think that this is an opportunity to actually remake the Mexican political system. And it's remaking it in the sense of going back to an older model of governing Mexico, where you had a hegemonic party, where you had president and Congress controlled by the same party. So we're looking at a presidency where there is a huge opportunity to actually make things happen. But as I say, the overall tendency that I see is actually one of much more of continuity than radical change.
A lot has been made, Duncan, as you know, about the potential clash between President Trump and Mr. López Obrador. Will there be a clash over migration and trade?
It all depends, I think. I mean, Andrés Manuel has been very clear throughout his campaign that one of the most important priorities for him is to maintain a relationship of respect with the United States, that he understands that that the economic relationship with the U.S., as well as the political relationship, is of fundamental importance to Mexico's prosperity and security. But, you know, Andrés Manuel is also the kind of figure who will react if there are tweeted insults to Mexico, the Mexican people, or to himself. He's not going to sit there and take it. And you could see the opportunity for a rapid escalation of conflict in a Twitter war. However, I think a lot of this actually comes down to whether or not President Trump wants to continue on his current path and his current trajectory, or whether, in fact, with a new government here in Mexico, he's willing to reach out and offer the olive branch.
Mr. López Obrador has been campaigning, Duncan, on reducing inequality, improving pay and welfare spending while running a tight budget. Can he accomplish those?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do that. You know, he claims that he'll be able to pay for all of these new social programs by cutting corruption and by cutting the fat in the government. And one of his sort of headline programs is that he's going to reduce the civil service, not in the sense of the general workforce, but the altos funcionarios, the high-level officials. He wants to reduce their number by a third. And he says that in and of itself will save an enormous amount of money that can be put to other purposes. He also claims that he can save around 20% of the federal budget by eliminating corruption, particularly in the procurement process. You know, most people I speak to are deeply skeptical about whether or not that will pay off, deeply skeptical about whether or not it's possible to eliminate corruption in a country like Mexico. So I think that there's still a huge question mark hanging over his plan for paying for these new programs without actually indebting the country.
Mexico, of course, as you know, Duncan, has been racked by crime and violence. What is his plan to deal with that?
That's one of the weaker points of his campaign, unfortunately. He's spoken very little about the security situation in the country. And when he has, he's offered some platitudes more than anything else, saying that he would offer amnesty to small producers of drugs, of heroin or of marijuana. But there's no real plan in place for actually confronting organized crime. He said that he would do things differently. But when you question him on it, there's no depth on the policy response. So I think that we're going to have to wait and see on this one. My expectation is that there will be probably much more of a continuation of current policy and strategy than there will be a departure from it. And the reason for that is because there's very few options left. You can't take the military off the streets in many parts of the country without leaving a power vacuum into which organized crime will spread. And the kingpin strategy of taking out the heads of organized crime, drug cartels, is one thing which at least it gives you some results that you can measure and you can present to the public, whereas the other strategies of crime prevention, of building resilient communities, pay off in the long term, and by that I mean 20, 25 years, which were politicians far too long.
Duncan, was this a vote against the ruling pre-party or for Mr. López Obrador?
The answer is yes. It was both of those things. You know, the number one issue for Mexicans in this election was to make sure that the current ruling party didn't retain power. But at the same time, there's a lot of people in Mexico who see Andrés Manuel López Obrador as the great hope for the country. They see him as a man who might be able to actually turn the tables in their favor, that might be able to effect meaningful change for them. And then there's somebody out there who's offering something different.
That's Duncan Wood. He is director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. And he was speaking from Mexico City with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The monitoring group 38 North says satellite images are showing rapid improvement have been made in recent months at one of North Korea's nuclear research sites. That report was released just after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un signed a declaration to denuclearize following the Singapore summit with President Trump. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with David Albright, a former UN weapons inspector and now president of the Institute for Science and International Security.
They're working on various facilities. Now, I would say these aren't critical facilities. I mean, they're mostly doing what we would call kind of secondary or auxiliary buildings to the main nuclear facilities. So there hasn't been anything significantly changed about the kind of nuclear potential of Yongbyon in quite a while. And so I think the media overblew the 38 North report. I mean, the 38 North report was essentially trying to give an update on what's going on at the site. And as we've done maybe last month or month and a half ago, and the media thought it was some big development of that somehow disproves Trump. And it really has almost no relationship to President Trump's statement. As an outsider, I can say this. I mean, I'm not hostile to the administration or in any way, but I think Trump tends to wildly exaggerate and speak spontaneously. But I think within the administration, they're well aware that the summit didn't mark the end of North Korea's nuclear progress on building its nuclear arsenal. And in fact, the point of the negotiations that are ongoing after the summit is to indeed create an agreement where not only is that progress stopped, but reversed, and you get denuclearization. Now, another part of this is that people often just think that what they can see in these commercial satellite images is all the nuclear program there is. And in fact, I know we published in late May, it was covered in the Post, that North Korea likely has another uranium enrichment plant that can make nuclear explosive material, in this case, weapon-grade uranium for nuclear weapons. North Korea has always denied having it, took a lot of work in the intelligence community to find it. And the name we learned about was called Kang Sung.
This seems to be a repeat of what has happened in previous generations of North Korean leadership, does it not?
No, not at all. I mean, North Korea hasn't agreed to anything yet. And And the nuclear facilities are, in negotiating terms, very valuable. And North Korea is going to want something for shutting those down and then dismantling them. This is a negotiation. Why would North Korea stop the activities at Yongbyon and these secondary or these auxiliary buildings were planned long ago? Why would they stop the construction and look like they're making a unilateral concession? And I think it's going to take some time. Now, Secretary of State Pompeo has made it clear that he's going to, you know, from his point of view, and I think President Trump supports this, is they're going to let it run probably through the elections and see if North Korea is willing to make that decision to denuclearize. And if they're not, then, you know, I hate to say this, we're going to probably end up back in a maximal pressure campaign against North Korea. And all the allies of the United States have agreed that that's the case. China obviously is more ambivalent about it, but technically it's also agreed. North Korea has to make commitments to denuclearize, or else this isn't going to work.
David Albright is a former UN weapons inspector, now president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Number of analysts are saying nothing could shift the U.S. political landscape more than the recent announcement by Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy that he's retiring from the High Court. President Trump has pledged to move quickly to fill the seat. VOA's Lori London asked Anna Rose Mathiasson, who co-manages the California Appellate Law Group, if Kennedy's replacement could lead the High Court to overturn long-standing decisions on social issues, such as the so-called Roe v. Wade decision, in which the court established a woman's right to have an abortion without undue restrictive interference from the government.
It's possible that a new justice would decide to respect what we call the principle of stare decisis. That is, adhering to what the court has already decided. So a new justice might write an opinion where they say, I don't agree that abortion should be legal, but the court has for decades allowed it, and it would profoundly shift and alter the fabric of our society to change that, and that itself is harmful to the law. So it is possible for some of these particularly divisive social issues that either a new justice or the chief justice could come to change their views, or even if they don't change their personal views, still want to respect what has been the law for decades.
Now, is that sort of a protocol in a way for justices to normally look back at what their predecessors voted on and pretty much go by that?
This principle of stare decisis, that is, looking to what the law, what has been said is the law, is really a key principle from the court. Of course, the court can and does reverse its prior decision, but it really tries to look at that and look at the reasons for doing that carefully and not simply reverse because of policy disagreements, to find really good reasons for that.
The whole question of ideology, this is the highest court in the land here in the U.S., and you would think that this would all be based on the Constitution and legality of things, and yet we're talking about conservative versus liberal.
It is never explicitly based on ideology. And it's really not even in any sort of conscious manners. The justices, none of them, are saying, this is the way I want it to come out, so I am going to find a way to come out that way. They all take their jobs incredibly seriously and are interpreting the law as they think the law and the Constitution require. But one's view of the law can profoundly vary. I mean, we have seen actually several times this year, even when you are applying the same set of techniques, even if you agree about how the law should be interpreted, you're going to reach different results.
There are questions, what happens with this investigation, the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, if the president, who says he has the ability to pardon himself, if for some reason he were to need to pardon himself, if he were actually able to do that, that is something that could potentially end up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Indeed, and that is incredibly difficult to predict how that would...
I mean, is that something you could see being brought to the Supreme Court in a case that they would have to be dealing with?
So there's a thing traditionally known as the political question doctrine, which says the court tries not to get involved in certain incredibly hot-button political issues, not issues that are politically charged. Obviously, abortion and gay rights are incredibly politically charged, but rather decisions that are in the Constitution assigned to a different branch. And so there would certainly be an argument if there was a challenge to the president's ability to pardon himself. There would certainly be an argument that the court should not be able to review that challenge, because the Constitution does give the president pardon power and doesn't explicitly say he may not pardon himself. And therefore, it is, in a sense, a political question whether or not this extends to it. And it's the sort of question that the Constitution gives power to the executive and not the courts over. Now, there are a number of counterarguments and reasons why the courts might be an appropriate forum. The courts usually can hear a variety of criminal issues, and there certainly are counterarguments, but I think the political question would be one of the most important responses to any challenge to the president's ability to pardon himself. And goodness, what a mess the country would be in then.
This is a very big deal that the president is getting to choose another U.S. Supreme Court. In your view, is this a very big deal?
Absolutely. It really, particularly in the civil rights area, it has the potential to alter laws that we have depended on for decades, and more recent laws that people have based their personal lives around.
That is Anna Rose Mathiasen, co-manager of the California Appellate Law Group. She was speaking with VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Cassini mission, which provided a close look of Saturn, its moons, and famous rings for 13 years, came to a blazing end on September 11, 2017. One of the highlights of the Cassini mission was the 2014 discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above Saturn's moon Enceladus. A team of scientists led by the University of Heidelberg, Germany, studied data gathered by Cassini and identified fragments of large, complex organic molecules containing hundreds of atoms originating from Saturn's icy moon. Cassini had previously detected smaller, more common organic molecules at Enceladus. The scientists say the existence of these large complex molecules, along with hydrothermal activity on the moon, supports a theory that a massive liquid water ocean below the icy crust of Enceladus may provide a habitable environment for life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
I can't fool myself, I don't want nobody else to ever love me. I'm a shining star, my guiding light, my love that you see. There's not a minute, hour, day, or night that I don't love you. You're at the top of my list, cause I'm always thinking of you. I still remember in the days when I was scared to touch you, how I spent my day dreaming, planning how to say I love you. You must have known that I had feelings deep enough to swim in. That's when you opened up your heart and you told me to come in.
Luther Vandross was an American singer, songwriter, and record producer. Throughout his career, he was an in-demand background vocalist for numerous artists, becoming lead singer of the group Change, which released its gold-certified debut album in 1980. After Vandross left the group, he became a solo artist and released his debut solo album, Never Too Much, in 1981.
much, never too much, never too much, never too much.
During his career, Luther Vandross sold more than 35 million records worldwide and received 8 Grammy Awards, including Best Male R&B Vocal Performance, 4 different times. He won a total of 4 Grammy Awards in 2004, including the Grammy Award for the Song of the Year for a song recorded not long before his death, Dance with My Father.
Back when I was a child, before life removed all the innocence, my father would lift me high and dance with my mother and me, and then spin me around till I fell asleep. Then up the stairs he would carry me, and I knew for sure I was loved. If I could get another chance, another walk, another dance with him, I'd play a song that would never, ever end. How I'd love, love, to dance with my father again. Ooh.
Luther Vandross suffered from diabetes and hypertension. In 2003, he suffered a severe stroke at his home in New York City and was in a coma for nearly 2 months. That stroke affected his ability to speak and sing and required him to use a wheelchair. His last public appearance was on May 6, 2004 on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Vandross died on July 1, 2005 at the age of 54 of a heart attack.
Under my sheet, never dreamed that he would be gone from me. If I could steal one final glance, one final step, one final dance with him, I'd play a song that would never, ever end, 'cause I'd love, love, love with my father again. Sometimes I'd listen outside her door, and I'd hear how my mother cried for him. I pray for her even more than me. I pray for her.
In 1995, Luther Vandross released a very popular album called Songs. It was a collection of cover versions of classic hits, going on to earn him 4 Grammy Award nominations. Here is the cover of the Stephen Stills hit, Love the One You're With.
In a fisted glove.
You know, it was 13 years on Sunday that Luther Vandross had died. It just amazes me that he's been gone that long. But we have the hundreds of recordings of Luther's many, many songs, and of course all the videos of his performances. He performed all over the world, magnificent things. You should check them out on YouTube. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. Up next is the latest world news. We hope you'll stay with us for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Luther Vandross.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent interview, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned that there would be dire consequences for Iran if the regime's leaders, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and Qasem Soleimani, commander of the IRGC Quds Force, restarted a nuclear weapons program. Secretary Pompeo said that United States allies in the Middle East, as well as European allies with whom the U.S. disagrees about the value of the Iran nuclear deal, all understand the threat that Iran presents. Whether it's a malign activity with Hezbollah, or in Yemen, or in Syria, or in Iraq, or its missile program that is launching missiles into airports that Westerners travel through. There is a unified understanding of Iran's malevolent behavior, he declared, and it will be an incredibly united world should Iran choose to head down a nuclear weapons path. Secretary Pompeo said he is referring to the moral opprobrium and economic power that would be marshaled against the Iranian regime should its leaders take that path. I'm not talking to military action here, he said. I truly hope that's never the case. It's not in anyone's best interest for that. But make no mistake, President Donald Trump has been very clear. Iran will not get a nuclear weapon nor start its weapons program on this president's watch. There is another course available to Iran, Secretary Pompeo noted, which would allow Iran to become a member of the Community of Nations. He laid the required dozen steps out in detail last month. He reiterated some of them. Stop launching missiles into non-hostile nations. Cease support of terrorism around the world. Don't go down the path of a nuclear weapons system. The asks from the United States in order for Iran to return to the Community of Nations are all we ask of other countries around the world to be part of the international system, he said. Recently, through his Twitter account, Secretary of State Pompeo again expressed support for the Iranian people as they seek to exercise their fundamental human rights. Those are, after all, the people who would most benefit from a change in the policies of their government. Such support, Mr. Pompeo said, is a mark of President Trump and our administration. We are very hopeful that there will be an increase in democratic values and the capacity for Iranians to speak their mind inside the Islamic Republic of Iran.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.